This is Photo Geek Weekly, episode 13, ominously, recorded on February 6th of 2018. And for this very unlucky episode, I have a photographer that I consider to be a, I don't want to say a kingmaker, but you have done me a solid in the past, in a previous life. And I'm glad that we've had a chance to connect just a few times over the past few years. But this is Brian Matiash, who you might know from the No Name Photo Show. You've had, where are you working professionally these days, Brian?
Well, for Don, first of all, thank you for having me in for that illustrious intro. It's been a pleasure, you know, watching, especially like you mentioned, from our early Google Plus days, helping the way that I could from when I was working at Google. But currently, to answer your question, I live in Lincoln, Nebraska. That's where my wife and I have our own kind of photo businesses. So that's where we kind of operate out of. And I'm in my home office right now.
That's fantastic. And I mean, I'm in my home office too. And it's funny because I always look behind people and think, okay, well, what is that on the shelf? What is that on the desk? What pieces of photo geekery lie behind you? I'm not seeing much besides a couple of boxes.
I have it all sequestered in my closet because sometimes the OCD in me freaks out. And also, you know, if you are on camera, you kind of want to present a little bit of it could be pretty crazy, Don. Definitely, you have a fellow geek in me.
Okay, good. You know, it's interesting when I think the last time I saw you in person was at the Can-Am Photo Expo,
right,
in Buffalo, New York. And so, you know, you ran off so quickly. I wasn't able to sit down and have a great chat with you about whatever was on my mind at the time. So now I get to pick your brain. And really dive into the details of what's current now, but what's been keeping you busy? You said you're you know, doing your own photo business and what have you. What does that entail for you?
So I mean, that very much, I would say, in a way, I think it wouldn't be any of a surprise to you. It's a lot of it is content creation. You know, you're selling. You recently have your book that came out. I've had a book published. It's creating videos. It's working with companies, partnering with companies. It's social media. It's basically everything where trying to establish as many viable, sustainable kind of either passive or active revenue streams. So sometimes it's getting my stock portfolio updated with Stocksy, that kind of stuff. So that's basically done from a day-to-day. It's content creation in one form or another, or partner management.
You know, the reason I ask is because I just did a presentation to my local college today, to a class that I would have been sitting in 10 years ago. And it was a presentation. I graduated from the advertising program at Georgian College. And, you know, I sat down to put the presentation together and made a list of all of the things that I do, maybe not necessarily on a weekly basis, but within a year as a revenue stream. And it was about 50 things on that list. Everything from cleaning camera sensors from colleagues that come to me and say, hey, you know what, I've got, you know, four dirty cameras. Can you clean them? Yeah, you know, it's not a hard thing for me to do. To image editing for others, to, you know, licensing photographs and selling through fine art and book sales and sponsorships and all of that stuff. And I got to thinking, you know, this is actually pretty good job security, because if one of those things disappear, there's never enough time in each day to do everything that I have on my table, from, you know, mentorships or, you know, video tutorials that I still have a whole bunch of them I need to create. And, you know, it's great, you know, to sit down and do this podcast once a week and hopefully that will end up being a piece of the pie, which it isn't right now, but it's still really fun to do. And I'm glad that we've got people listening to it. Just like I know that you're enjoying with Sharky James, the No Name Photo Show, which, you know, it's fun to just be passionate about what we do. And I think that we're really lucky to be in a position, and I try hard not to take it for granted, that I can keep the lights on doing what I love. And that's not to say I'm working 40-hour weeks. I don't think I ever have. 100 hours is about the maximum, and it's somewhere in between those two that that keeps me busy. But hey, we're kindred spirits, I hear.
Absolutely, and I think you really nailed it, the kind of the soul of a photographer. And I hate to use the word, but it really is true the way you describe it, but an entrepreneur where you are, the two of us, and like you said, kindred spirits, have to make sure that we are diversifying what we do in terms of income stream, because you're absolutely right. You never know. One thing you can have I had a really great project with Zeiss, for example, that was very lucrative over the course of about 4 to 5 months. And then when that project ended in its natural, terminus, I had to make sure that when that ended, I was able to recover, that the wages that I would have had normally from there. So, not to kind of go too far down the rabbit hole, but I really like the way you describe it. And I do think that, for today's kind of modern digital online photographer really needs to understand more the importance of the business side, the entrepreneurial side, the kind of like,
especially because photographers are not photographers anymore, at least if they're professionals. I mean, I'm doing more video now than I have in the past. And sure. I have a documentary film crew. I'm not sure if I can say much more about that, but they're coming to my studio tomorrow and the day after. Mm-hmm. And we're going to spend most of those days filming stuff that I know I can do, but I've never done and I've never seen anybody do before. So there's a certain trial and error and experimentation and pushing limits into new realms. And so I think about, I had worked on a documentary film, a year ago November, for Discovery Channel called Mosquito. And they approached me because I'd worked with some of their staff before on a different project, and they knew that I could do some really, high-end macro photography and videography. So they enlisted me to do mosquitoes on pins, photographed in focus stacking methodology to get it completely sharp from tip to tip, mm-hmm. and then rotating on a pin. So that means that I have to focus stack it, and then I have to rotate it 1 degree and focus stack it again and rotate it 1 degree with algorithmic autonomy. That means that it's consistent from one sequence to the next. So Absolutely. Even if there are some flaws or whatever, it doesn't look like I've edited them myself separately. It has to be consistent. And so I did that. I had to get some hardware from Cognisys. They make the stack shot, and they've got a rotational platform, and it's very, very programmable. But I had just started experimenting with ultraviolet fluorescence. And so I found a dead mosquito in my sunroom, and I set it up to photograph in ultraviolet. And it fluoresced. It glowed blue, which is the strangest thing. That's the most beautiful mosquito I've ever seen.
That's an oxymoron.
Yeah, it is. But it was enigmatic and it had a certain fascination to it. And I showed it to them, and immediately that was added to my shot list for the 3 days that we were shooting at Brock University. And they even did a little behind the scenes video of me doing that. I'll actually put a link to that in the show notes so anybody Very cool. can check that out. And it was fun. It was something that I didn't even know what to, they couldn't give me a shot list to shoot for because they didn't even know what the possibilities were. They said, hey, just experiment, do everything you possibly can in the time given. And it ended up as the title card in the documentary. So I was pretty thrilled with the results. But you don't know where that's going to come from. Sure. I can wake up the next morning and say, oh, well, there's this wonderful opportunity, or, oh, somebody's just ordered 10 prints, or maybe nothing. January was a pretty slow month for me, but things kind of come in waves. I write for certain magazines, and there's a check every quarter from Outdoor Photography Canada. Yep. I've produced some coins from the Royal Canadian Mint, and of course they pay nicely for that. But it's all right. Rolling in money today, and then the rest of the month is hello, is anybody there?
Absolutely. I mean, it's like, I think I would wager any other. Where you're a self-employed venture, it's the peaks and valleys. And more importantly, it's during the peaks, have you done the proper savings and taxes and stuff to make sure that it could sustain you through the valleys?
Yeah. And, I get asked a lot, with the work that I do somewhat famously with snowflakes. And I get a lot of people coming up to me and saying, oh, well, have you researched the work of Masaru Emoto, who is a Japanese scientist? He had a PhD. He's since passed on. But he wrote some books on hidden messages in water and, the vibrations and the positive energies and intentions that you might be able to put into to water. Or he extended that to snowflakes and the crystal formations. And you know, he never peer reviewed any of his work. He never properly documented his full results. And he was, you know, fairly harshly criticized by both the scientific community and the spiritual community to some degree. I mean, all you have to do is look at this guy's Wikipedia page. But I get a lot of people that are saying, oh, have you studied this? And well, it's not real if it hasn't been peer reviewed. And I know, looking at snowflakes that will fall outside, one beautiful one will fall next to one ugly one. And there's no intention inscribed into either of those. They just fell from the sky.
Sure.
So you can manipulate the content to be whatever you want it to be. And there's an audience for that. Right. And so he's sold like a million copies of these books and people know him with some fame. If I was after money exclusively, I could write a book just like his and I would probably sell more copies of that than I have the book that I actually published on snowflakes, which didn't sell poorly at all. But, you know, if you're after the dollars, you know, there's always a way to that. And you can kind of sell your soul in some cases, depending on how you want to go about it. So that kind of preambles into the first story that we're talking about today, which is an article that I found on F-Stoppers titled A Tale of Two Moons, which details an image that has been recently released by Peter Lick. And it was somewhat, I don't want to say controversial, but questionable in its authenticity in how real this shot was, which is this wonderful cliffside with some straggly but beautiful looking trees kind of clinging to the rocks. And in behind is a very beautiful orange crisp moon that is framing the foreground almost in silhouette, but not quite. It's a stunning shot, actually, until you dive in a little bit deeper and you realize that it might not be everything that it claims to be. And so I'll read a quote here, and then I want to pass it off to you, Brian.
Sure.
The quote is from Peter Lick. This shot has eluded me my entire photographic career. I searched for days to line up this classic tree with the moon. The golden sphere slowly rose in front of me. I pressed the shutter, a feeling I'll never forget. This is so grandiose. The moon, the tree, and Earth. And so why don't you take it from there and describe sort of what the controversy is in your eyes?
Sure. Well, I would think, well, first of all, that was a wonderful segue, your analogy into this story. So I really appreciated that. At first I was like, wait, where's Don going with this? So I would say that the controversy could be beautifully summed up if you go to the F-Stoppers link that Don mentioned. There is a before and after slider. So they have two versions of these photos by Peter Lick, and there's a slider that you can scrub left and right. And in my opinion, the crux of the controversy is the fact that, it, you know, at face value, this looks like an identical moon, the same exact moon in both photos, but with a different foreground overlaid. Now, listen, I've composited photos, and I've never once attempted to deceive. In fact, when I do composite a photo and I share it, I wear it as a badge. Like, you know, if anything, if you want to go ahead, try to criticize my compositing skills, fine. But I've never tried to be deceptive. When I look at the photo here, like you said, first of all, between that quote that Peter Lick, this really kind of saccharine quote that he has, and then also just the notoriety that this particular photographer has in this industry, it's one thing if you, like I said, if you want to composite and you put it out there, it's another thing to do it under, I would say, false pretense, you know, not exactly making it seem like this was an original straight out of camera, you know, single exposure, you know, God's way type of photo.
It seems like his that quote that I read seems to lead us down exactly that path, that this was an out of camera shot, and that this is the way the world can be seen. But it's really important to question that. Whenever somebody shows you something that you say can't be real, maybe it is, but don't ever take that at face value. And these people did not. And so there were a few very key ingredients within this. You mentioned that before and after slider. Mm-hmm. And I noticed a very interesting thing as I'm just moving this back and forth right now, the upper left-hand, or sorry, the upper right-hand mm-hmm. corner of the moon yep. On the new photograph versus the old one, the shadows don't make any sense. The shadows are just like a golden cutout compared to what they would have to be if the moon fades into shadow. And to me, that just kind of raises an eyebrow a little bit. But when you follow the curve of the moon all the way down to the bottom where the trees are, you've got clouds both in front of the moon, very clearly at the bottom, but then you've got clouds behind the moon. Yeah. And the moon cannot be in between the clouds. That's an impossibility.
That would make for some very interesting environmental impact on this planet.
I think that it would. But if we dive even further down, the comments were lovely on this article. Because if I go deep enough down there, somebody that's identifying themselves only as DR says the location is the Yang Zhijie National Forest Park in China. I probably butchered that name. And if you take a look at that shot, there are mountains in behind those trees. Like the angle for which he is shooting at, the moon would not even be seen because there's a horizon there that would obstruct it. And so when you compare it to what other people have taken in exactly that same location, not only did he put a moon there, but he completely replaced the background that would have been there to begin with. And so as you continue to dive further and further into this, it becomes more and more an impossibility. Now, like you, I call photography art. And as soon as you make that connection, you play by your own rules, right? Just like any artist or musician or whatever, you can make anything that you want and you can call it art. It is your creation. But if there is an implied or an explicit sense of documentary value, like this is documenting the world the way that it is, and it's explicit because he says so. Mm-hmm. It's implied if it's saying, photographing like two birds attacking each other, for example. Well, what if those two birds exist on separate continents? And you're compositing that together and you don't say anything. Or if you set up a perch for a bird on a particular type of tree that doesn't exist in that particular area, you know, there are certain things that would have a documentary value intrinsically to the ingredients at play that if you've manipulated in some way, then you're deceiving people. So that deception, I think, is really the crux of this issue here. And I guess the real question is, what's to be done about it?
Well, the thing is that, again, it boils down to the persona that Peter Lick has been trying to sell for his entire career, you know, and I'm not taking anything away from him for doing so. You know, we talked about this before we started recording. I own a few of his books, and I think because he does have, you know, you can't take that away from him. He does have some beautiful photos. And
oh, exactly.
If you were to eliminate if you were to kind of take a knife and just shave off this layer of authenticity and this kind of serendipity that he's trying to sell with this photo, if you were just kind of take it at face value, it's a cool photo. I mean, it's a bit obnoxious how big this moon is and what he's trying to sell with it. But my umbrage is whether or not he was trying to make this more of an authentic single exposure. It's his brand that has been built around being this consummate photographer. And when you try to pass something along that isn't, you know, authentic, it's all the whole entire charade, the whole illusion is shattered. And I said this before, like I see him as a showman. I see him very much to a lesser extent, and this is also could be controversial, but I see him kind of like a Donald Trump of photography.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and not in his worst ways, but as kind of this, it's all about the image. It's all about the superficiality, about his brand, about how people see him. You know, again, that whole, the $9 million print, that whole hoopla from a few years ago, to me, I don't care. I just want to appreciate a good photo. However,
I think it was 6 point something million, but the point still stands that, you know, if you compare that image to some of the other highly priced images, what was it? The Rhine 2, sold for $4.3 million, if I'm not mistaken. And it's some horizontal lines running across a frame. It's not a really standoff picture. In fact, the Phantom 2, which is Peter Lick's higher priced image, is a more desirable photograph, but it's one in Antelope Canyon, right, that a million other photographers have something so close, almost identical to. So at that point, people are buying the artist. They're not buying the art.
Exactly.
And so he has done a great job at branding himself. He's one of the most commercially successful photographers there is. And there has been some controversial studies based on the resale value of his work. For those that aren't familiar with how Peter Lick prices his images, and I'm not going to use actual numbers here because I don't have them handy, but he'll run a series of, let's say, 100 or 1,000, let's say 1,000 copies of a particular print. And the first 100 of them will be at X dollar value. And the next 100 will be X dollars plus a certain percentage and so on and so forth. So if you buy the image as the series gets closer towards its completion, then you're paying much more than the person that bought one of the very first ones. And there is a perceived increase in value for those that will buy in early, because people that buy in late are going to be paying much more. Now, the problem is, what happens when you try to resell it? And there were some investigative journalism endeavors put in play that basically showed the resale value of these images is almost universally less than what you paid for it, regardless of how much you paid for it. But the perception of a value increase is where he's making his money. It's brilliant marketing, but it's marketing.
Right.
And so we can't kind of have to establish it as that and kind of move past that and see, well, what is he doing? His prints are gorgeous. If you've ever seen a print from Peter Lick in person, whatever printing process he uses is, you know, secondary to magic. There's vibrance and pop. They jump off the page, off the print. So, you know, he does a good job, but he is a branding master. And this hurts his brand, I think, because it's one of those things that kind of tarnishes everything. But the true fans of his work might not ever even notice it, because it's not like he's going to be promoting this.
Sure.
You're going to see this in the photographic community being critical of him, but the fine art community might just completely blow this one over.
Absolutely. And I mean, you can say the same to a different extent in terms of when the illusion is shattered. Same thing with Steve McCurry with his in 2016, whole controversy that came out with him, where it was proven that his photos were doctored. And again, Steve McCurry, if Peter Lick is kind of supposed to be the kind of the consummate, you know, landscape and nature photographer who shoots on specialized film, you know, Steve McCurry was a consummate photojournalist. And
I grew up admiring his
absolutely.
Work.
Absolutely. And when it's not just when the story broke, but also then there were quotes where he's saying I'm not a photojournalist. I'm a visual storyteller. Well, you know, listen,
you can't really escape that, because right. National Geographic and all of the stories that I had seen you documented, that was pure photojournalism as I remember it to be. If you're deciding to change the name of that in a different light, in a different context, well, you might no longer be a photojournalist in your own opinion. But all of the work that is in question right now is when you were absolutely for certain a photojournalist. And I don't want to say that the illusion being shattered there hurts how I perceived it as a child looking through National Geographic. Those memories stay intact. But the respect of somebody trying to backpedal through those scenarios, right, it's cringeworthy. Right. You know, it's like, okay, well, you know, do you own it? Do you pass it off as a mistake from a staff member? I think one of Steve McCurry's assistants like famously stole a bunch of stuff from him too. So maybe his staff can be blamed for some of that. But at the same time, we see these people that get caught in a fabrication. Right. And it's really hard to evolve from that. I mean, just be honest about your work. I don't mind compositing a photograph. I mean, when I'm doing snowflakes or a lot of my macro work, I'm doing focus sure. stacking, and that's a kind of compositing. But I don't mind throwing some extra birds in a photograph. Or I've got this exercise that I give my students where I take a photograph of my grandpa on a lawn chair sitting next to his Jeep that he sold before he got to take it on any adventures. and I instruct my students to cut it out from the background, put him on some adventure somewhere. And, you know, it's an exercise in compositing for realism, to create proper reflections on the windows of the Jeep and shadows underneath, and to color grade the two images together. It actually works quite well as a lesson. He's been to the moon. He's been to an active combat zone in Afghanistan. He's been to the Great Wall of China. You know, it's so fun when people have the freedom to just say, okay, let's just have fun with this and explore what a composite can be. And there's no question that it's a composite. Nobody is saying that it's not. And it should be enjoyed for its activity as it is. Heck, just even for yourself, take a picture of yourself, cut out the background, put you, you know, in whatever that color festival is in India. And
no, the Holi festival.
Yeah. And, you know, throw yourself up on the Eiffel Tower, or, you know, just enjoy
Absolutely.
It. But don't make it some, you know, facsimile to reality, because it certainly isn't. Now, I do want to say about this moon, the scientist in me wants to state two things. The moon, when it's that low to the horizon, would not be round. It would be distorted and squished. So right away, I can see that's a very round moon. That would not happen. And its clarity through that much atmospheric distortion, it would be all wobbly and woozly. It would not be nearly as clear as we're seeing here. And if you've ever photographed the moon as it rises over a lake or a body of water, right when it's crossing the horizon, you'll see it's squished and wiggly. It's not a good moon. You know, when it goes a little bit higher, maybe. But again, here we are knowing that this is lower than the horizon line in the background with the mountains that should be there. So anyhow, I think we might have talked this one to death. But I think it is a good discussion about what art and photography is and how to be genuine to yourself and to your customers. Because as soon as you start lying to them and you get caught, it's a slippery slope.
Absolutely.
Right. Now, I'm no stranger to enjoying some good gear talks and about the latest and greatest tech, even stuff that might be unattainable to us on a personal level. But quick question, Brian, what is the fastest frame rate for video that you have personally ever shot?
Well, I mean, I have a Sony RX100 Mark V, and that's capable of, I believe, 960 frames per second at, if I remember correctly, that is 720p. And then if you want to get 1080p, it drops the frame rate to 420, or 460. I can't remember, but that's as fast as I've ever gone. More often than not, on a more pedestrian sense, I'll just use the slow-mo on my iPhone 10, at 120.
Have you ever used that 960 mm-hmm. frames per second for anything that that was, hey, you know what, we need this and it looks awesome?
It's more the first time I used it was when I went to Cuba in 2016, and we were in convertibles of, you know, those classic cars, those older legacy cars all around Havana, and so we would be zipping down one of the streets, and I do some slow motion as the car was driving. So you have the pedestrians, when you couple fast motion with people also in motion, it creates a really nice effect.
It's almost a bullet time.
Exactly.
Effect, yeah.
Exactly. And so, but for any sort of practical purposes or for any sort of scientific purposes, I have not.
Well, what if you could add a zero to that?
Oh yeah. it would be interesting. Although it to me is maddening, because you have to time whatever it is. With the RX100, there's a buffer, a very finite buffer, where from when it starts and stops recording. And if you miss whatever the key kind of action is, then the clip is gone and you have to wait for it to process. So what we're about to talk about, you know, I think would be very, very cool.
Right. So there's a new camera from Phantom, and Phantom is known as the brand of the highest frame rate cameras that are commercially available. And it can shoot at 6,600 frames per second at 4 megapixels. Now, if you're not familiar, 1080p, which is 1920 by 1080, multiply those numbers, you're at about 2 megapixels. So you're at about twice the resolution of a full HD. And at 6,600 frames per second, and if you want to scale it down to 1080p, you know, full HD, then you're almost at 12,000 frames per second.
It's mind-boggling.
So Yeah, it's now there's a few problems when you get to frame rates that high. Number one, the light that you need per frame is so intense that if you were in like everyday scenarios like bright sunlight and what have you, the images will be almost dark. Like you need to create much more light than the sun is capable of producing in order to get these cameras to give you something that is usable at those extreme speeds anyhow. I mean, at more moderate speeds like you might find with explosions on Mythbusters or what have you, you can use ambient light. But now we're really pushing past those limits at these speeds. I do remember when I was on the Discovery Mosquito shoot, when we were shooting the mosquitoes in high speed using a phantom camera, we had to hit them with so much light that it was killing the mosquitoes.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. I forget exactly what frame rate we were working on, but the light is so condensed and so hot that they wouldn't fly because, well, I'm not sure if they were dead per se, but they were sweltering. Sure. And it was not a comfortable scenario. And I don't want PETA to be on my neck about mosquitoes dying. I kill them all the time myself, almost for pleasure when they land on.
Yeah, you know, they are sucking your blood literally. So wait, when you
quite literally lit right.
that mosquito, was it, did you have to like snoot the light? Was it like a really concentrated beam of light?
It was really concentrated, and if I remember correctly, because I was not I was kind of observing this particular suit, so I shouldn't comment as if it's 100% factual. But they basically timed the light to turn on as soon as they thought the mosquito was about to flutter and take off. Rumor has it they would die in the air. But you would get the shot of them flapping Absolutely. Their wings and everything. And so, yeah, you can use a faster lens with a wider aperture. But at a macro scale, you can't. You need a smaller aperture in order to get enough in focus for the shot to be meaningful and useful. So when it comes to creating high speed footage, there are hurdles that we don't normally see. If you were to use one of these cameras, first thing is they're louder than my car. Like the fans in them to keep them cool are not quiet, and these cameras don't, of course, record audio, but they will have a disk, like an SSD of whatever capacity you choose, maybe a terabyte or so, that will constantly cycle through itself. So you can leave the camera running and wait for that action to happen. And it's like a constant back buffer to that point. So depending on the speed and the capacity, you stop the camera and you have 2 seconds prior to that stop that is exactly. recorded. So you see exactly what action has just happened. You've got to be on the finger to stop it on time, because if you don't, you've lost the shot because it's overwritten itself.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was getting to with that RX100, that buffer in terms of timing. You can either do a front or a rear trigger or a front and rear recording with that camera. So you can either press the button to begin the buffer or press the button to end the buffer, and it would have recorded the previous 10 seconds or so, or however much, based on your frame rate. But, you know, when I looked at the Petapixel article for this camera, there is a kind of an illustrative video embedded in there with what looks like some sort of a toothpick or an arrow or something going through a water balloon. And it's one of those things where you remember the old Maxell commercial where the guy sits down and turns on the presses the tape and just the audio blows him
blown back.
Yeah. That was me sitting in my chair watching that, just my entire face, just shockwave hit my face. It was so mind-bendingly cool watching the ripple, the way the surface of the balloon just went to nothing.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that subject matter, I think, was too slow for this camera. Like, you need to get this in front of an explosion or some sort of ballistic that's a little bit faster than an arrow potentially, or I don't even know, like fire a shotgun at a bunch of matches and you see all the pellets of the shotgun hit the matches and ignite them. Or I can't imagine what the possibilities would be.
I like that idea.
Yeah, that would be cool. You know, whoever wants to take high speed footage of that, please send me a link because I would love to see it. But at the same time, there's only so many things that you can shoot at that speed that could potentially be meaningful. Because like you had mentioned with people on the street, even at 960 frames per second, that's slow and kind of cool. But any slower than that, it's like, yeah, nothing's happening. Nothing's moving.
Yeah. It, at that point, if you're using it for practical purposes there, you know, if it's, for example, like you're using it for B-roll for a vlog or something, you're going to be cutting different snippets so often because no one's going to sit there and wait for that critical moment to happen. It's just going to take forever, you know, figuratively forever.
Well, and the funny thing is, you know, it's got what they say, a binning mode in monochrome only that shoots 1 megapixel. So that's about half of what HD is at 25,000 frames per second. Now, Okay, so because that's close enough to say 24 frames per second in terms of a number, let's say it's roughly 1,000 times more than that. So you take 1 second of footage, it's 1,000 seconds to play that back.
Yep.
And it gets really hard to scrub that footage to find any meaningful segment that you can relate to. Now, not to say that you need to use it at those highest speeds. Of course, the higher resolutions are always useful. But the fact that this equipment exists means that next year, it's going to be faster.
Absolutely.
And then this kind of equipment, well, it's very specialized, and I don't expect us to get a consumer version of it. I know you're getting 1,000 frames per second in point and shoot cameras. Yep. And that's going to improve as well. We're going to kind of close this gap on either side of it. And I think it'll be fun to try and find subjects that are very useful with this technology. The price, however, is scary. I don't know how much the price of this camera is. I don't think they announced it yet, but I did find a price for the 2511, which came out a little while ago.
Okay.
And it was $150,000 US.
Okay. So probably not going to make it on the Christmas list.
Probably not. But in most cases, I know people rent these cameras for a shoot rather than buying them and having one in-house the whole time. So that makes it sort of part of a budget for a documentary film shoot, and it's accounted for. You don't have to worry about owning it and the crazy depreciation of value that thing is going to have sitting in your closet for 2 months when it's not in use.
Yeah, I mean, take the money and use it to fund a crazy trip somewhere around the world. But, you know, this I can appreciate. This is what always kind of gets me when I think about in terms of specialty or specialized cameras. I understand why this camera needs to exist. There are applications, albeit very, very refined, very niche. But where I get confused is when I see, you know, I'll go on YouTube a lot and I'll see YouTubers, photographers or tech people. And they're doing these reviews of a phone, of an iPhone or of an Android, and they're using a Red cinema camera. I've always wanted to reach out to one of them, like Marques Brownlee or any one of these guys who is specifically using a Red cinema camera, 8K sensor, just beast mode, you know, where you can go out and film an actual movie, like cinema grade video. But you're in some sort of an office factory, you know, with some IKEA furniture, and you're recording thoughts on a phone. This is where I don't understand if we're talking about cameras and where the industry is going. Tell me that I'm missing something here, Don. It's kind of off topic, but when I'm thinking about the
money, it's all about money, because you know, who buys a Leica? Well, number one, somebody that can afford a Leica.
Sure.
But there is a certain prestige about using that. If you are, you know, somebody that is a famous YouTuber that has a very high income from that particular, you know, revenue source, well, okay, you have to buy a new camera. You've got, you know, $250,000 in the bank of disposable income. Are you going to put it to use on the best camera you can buy? Or are you going to be reasonable and say, I'm only going to buy the camera that I need for this purpose? Well, people can go either way, depending on how much, you know, is in their wallet. And so I don't think that it's purchased out of necessity. And I don't necessarily want to say it's purchased out of some sort of, you know, misaligned greed or need
or for that particular gear. Type thing.
Superficiality might be part of it. But, you know, maybe there is an idea saying, hey, you know what, I want to shoot 8K now so that in the future, you know, I can go back and say, you know, everything on YouTube is 8K a few years from now, and I've been doing it before anybody else. Yeah, maybe you're trying to tell that to yourself to justify it, and that's cool. But I think, who was it? It was the very early days when that, like, there was one 4K camera out on the market. And I remember hearing that there was a project that LeVar Burton was directing, who was Jordy LaForge.
Sure.
And, of course, my hero of Reading Rainbow. But he's done other projects since then, of course. And he was trying to create this project in 4K, or at least get the raw footage initially in that resolution. And this was well before it was consumerly accessible. I have no problem with that because that could be a timeless piece. But when you're reviewing a phone,
right,
that nobody will care about in 3 years at all,
let alone the video will get no months, probably.
But true enough. Then yeah, I think it's overkill. But hey, that same idea of perfection and having the budget for it, well, it's more of a why not kind of question.
Fair enough. I mean, I like the future proof idea. I get it. I just don't even when, and it is, I'm sure, when and not a if, when YouTube and other platforms begin supporting 8K resolution. Never mind the fact that the hit on bandwidth and streaming and displays that probably, you know, aren't even calibrated properly to appreciate that kind of footage, but so be it. It's just, I it was something that I wanted to bring up. I'm glad I got your take on it, and I've said my piece.
Okay, good. Well, you know, speaking of looking forward to future proofing and, you know, these great new cameras that are really pushing the limits of technology, those technologies don't get built into products until they're properly patented. And so we've got a number of patents that have come up over the last week that are from Canon. And there's one really interesting one and a few more that might kind of give us a glimpse as to what they're planning in the future. So the first patent that caught my eye was that Canon has the ability, or at least the recorded patent, to add fingerprint IDs to their cameras and lenses. So imagine this, if you will, where you grab your camera on the grip, there's a sensor that may or may not be invisible, who knows how it will be, you know, built into the camera, that will detect your fingerprint and then can customize the camera to you specifically. So if you've used that camera before and you've got some settings in there, you could register them to your fingerprint and have it automatically say, okay, well, this guy likes back button focus, or, you know, pure manual focus, or, you know, for all of the shoots that he does with this camera, it's in manual or it's always in aperture value, and will customize all of the camera settings, custom functions, whatever else you use, to match you. Or for a lens, you know, if you have a lens on there, maybe it's a telephoto lens that, you know, there are pre-programmed focus points that some of those cameras will have buttons for you to decide and to pre-program. Well, they're automatically set to you when you put your finger on there. Maybe it is a way to change the status of manual focus or image stabilization if they change the way that those settings are registered. So what do you think about this, Brian? Does this have legs? Is this something that you would like to see in cameras?
I definitely think it has legs. Biometrics is, we've obviously had biometrics with our phones for a few years now. Having it in, when I saw this article, I kind of smiled. I think something like having a fingerprint as far as identification purposes can be a really great thing. Cameras, let's talk about it from a theft perspective. Similar to an aftermarket car stereo, if you take the head unit, which typically is removable, off, the entire rest of the stereo usually is rendered useless without the head unit. So with cameras, I would love to see some sort of setting you can turn on or off, similar to phones, where if after n number of failed attempts, wipe this phone. Same thing with the camera. If after n number of failed fingerprint attempts, brick the camera or put it into a manufacturer's lock state. So in that respect, I would like to see that. I could see with a wedding, let's say a wedding photography team who often shares cameras for whatever purposes and wants to keep everything together. Well, you can use that as identification, like, oh, these are the photos I shot, and whether or not there are certain copyright implications to that, or simply for filtering out, you know, once you do a big dump of all of the photos, who took what. And then, of course, to what you said, using it as a quick preset, you know, a memory recall of particular settings.
I liked your idea for theft. I hadn't thought about that before, but what if it gets into some sort of lock mode, even silently, to say that, hey, you know what, the actual owner of this camera is not present. And I am going to, the next time that I am near a public Wi-Fi connection, because a lot of cameras now have public Wi-Fi or Bluetooth or whatever connectivity functionality built in, then you'll have the ability, and I'm just kind of brainstorming here, but for the camera to call home and say, hey, we don't know who has us right now, but it's not the person that has their registered settings, and this is our last known location.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's, you're 100% right. Might as well, if you're using biometric technology, you might as well couple that with more advanced wireless connectivity to do that. And also to similar to, I can see it kind of like those tiles that these little Bluetooth tiles that if you leave a certain proximity, you can mark it as stolen. And once it gets connection, other tile users can actually identify that this is a stolen tile. Little things like
that. Yeah, there's a few companies that produce that kind of hardware. Yes. And it'd be great if this could kind of pair with that in a meaningful way. But fast forward, if this technology does exist in a second or third iteration, imagine if the camera is always connected in some minimal way to a cloud service, or if you could have the camera connected via a cell phone or other device that has access. Somebody randomly on the street says, hey, can you take a picture of my family? You know, as you're doing a touristy shot, you take their camera, it has a biometric sensor, it's connected to the internet, it automatically pulls down your preferences for a camera, configures that camera for that moment that you're using it, you take that perfect picture without any questions about it, you hand the camera back to them, and it's back in their hands. It's a pipe dream. But
I love the idea where your head's at.
The technology, you know, once you put all of these different puzzle pieces together, there's a lot of possibilities for innovation.
Absolutely.
Sometimes it's scary, and people that are afraid of their privacy, well, you know, go live in the mountains somewhere, because that's a really hard thing to have when you're online in any context.
Sure.
But at the same time, can you use it in a way that doesn't necessarily infringe on your privacy in any way? Can some overarching government body come and say, oh, well, we know that Don has just picked up, Joe's camera at Niagara Falls to take a picture, and we know exactly where he was at that moment. Well, yeah, there might be a database with that information somewhere if this is, you know, in the cloud per se.
Absolutely.
So you'd have to be comfortable with that. But hey, the advantages come along with whatever compromises there are therein.
I would like to see just one last thing about this. It would be cool to tie some sort of additional security in terms of, and I'm not talking about theft, but for example, something as passive as preventing, or if you hit the preview button to look at photos on the card that's currently in the camera, if you're right now, I can take your camera, I can take anyone's camera that I have access to, hit the play button, and look at whatever content is on that card. So it would be great to have an option to automatically either encrypt or lock that feature, so that if you hit the play button unsuspectingly, or someone else hits it, they can't view it. It just says it's locked. Or, like I said, even to use it to actually encrypt the SD card so that the content is protected.
Yeah, top secret military uses could come in handy here as well. Because what if, again, just an idea, but if you are an image tech out in the field and you're taking pictures, maybe you do not have the ability to delete a photograph.
Sure.
You can take all the pictures that you want, but it's your supervisor that would have the authority to unlock the delete feature. But you have only the ability to record images and not hide anything that might be, worthy of documenting that you know, maybe somebody does something wrong. You're trying to cover it up for them. There's a certain accountability that could be enforced using this type of technology.
Like a super user kind of, parameter based on the biometrics.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of possibilities for this tech. And, you know, a patent is the first step towards seeing this in a viable product. So I'm happy we're at least at this stage.
Let me ask you then, do you see, let's say 5 years from now, when this technology is ready, do you see Canon, since they're the ones with the patent, implementing it in their higher end 1D series, 5D series, or do you see them putting it in more of the consumer grade, you know, Rebel 50D, 70D type of series?
If history repeats, Canon typically doesn't put the latest cutting edge tech in the 1D bodies, right, in terms of innovation,
right,
anyhow.
Right.
They'll put it in like one or two steps lower. They're not going to put it in a Rebel, at least not something of this caliber, anyhow. But you know, you might find that in a 5D,
sure,
or some sort of bridge camera between the 5D and the 1D, if such a thing were to exist. And then it gets tried and tested there as a test bed for one generation of product before it moves into the flagship. That's what they've done in the past. I know that the 1DX Mark II, which I currently shoot with, has dual pixel autofocus, but it does not have the ability to record DPAF RAW. Mm. That does exist in some other cameras. The 5D Mark IV, I think, has it. But there's no reason why it can't be in the 1DX Mark II. They just decided to leave that off. For whatever reason, maybe it wasn't mature enough, and that'll come in the next version, I'm sure.
Sure. I mean, back when I was a Canon, I shot Canon for 10 years, and one of the features I'd always wished and lamented when I saw that they implemented into a sub 5D camera was GPS.
Yes.
You know, I had the GP2 radio. Geotagging is very important for my work.
So here's what I did, Brian. I had the 5D, yes, Mark II. Okay.
Yes.
And it can be GPS aware, but you had to buy the Wi-Fi grip for it. So not the regular battery grip, but you have to buy the Wi-Fi grip, which was like $800 or something stupid. And it took an extra battery, but only for its own functionality. So it wasn't giving you any extra battery life at the same time. And then you could plug in a third-party GPS that talked within the specific protocol. And then they came out with a second version that let you plug in a Bluetooth dongle that, of course, Canon didn't make either. So you've got that third-party device talking to another third-party device, talking to this peripheral that is probably very poorly tested. Oh, and
what could go wrong?
I bought it all. And so it worked twice, maybe.
Nice.
And I even glued a hot shoe onto the GPS unit that I bought so that I could sit that in the hot shoe on the camera. And yeah, it was great until like you turn the camera off and then you've got to fumble, sure, and reset everything. That takes 10 minutes to get everything all synced back up. That sucked. I went there. Yeah. I was cutting edge. And yeah, so I have some image files from the 5D Mark II that have GPS information embedded in the RAW files. Hurrah. When I upgraded to the 1DX, the first thing I bought was the GPS add-on that plugged into the side, and it was perfect. And the 1DX Mark II has that built into the camera body as well. So I'm set now. But I'm right with you. Knowing where you are in any given moment is so valuable. I'm a lazy photographer in the sense that I'm not going to go through my image catalog in Lightroom and keyword stuff. But if you have GPS information, it will reverse geotag everything. So if you are in front of the Eiffel Tower, you get the keywords of Paris, France, and Eiffel Tower automatically associated with your photograph. You don't have to do anything to get it there. If I want to recall all of the images that I've taken in the Yukon, and I've made two trips up there, all I have to do is type that into the any word or any term field in Lightroom, and all of those images come flooding back. And I didn't have to do anything about that.
Yeah, sadly, I lost that ability when I switched to Sony. And for some reason, Sony has no inclination of supporting natively any sort of GPS. They have this really wonky, they'll pair to your phone over Bluetooth and utilize whatever the phone's GPS coordinates are at the time and match it with the time date of the... It's not an elegant solution at all.
Well, if you don't have GPS functionality in your camera, there is an option, it's supported by Lightroom, where you can get a separate GPS geo tracker that, sure, every, you know, 30 seconds or whatever, it, you know, sticks in a log file your exact GPS coordinates, and they run on a battery, and they typically last forever, like a week or two before you need to recharge them. And Lightroom can take that that track log and load that in, time sync it to your images. Let's hope those match up, like you weren't in a different time zone or something.
Don't forget to change the time zone.
And then you can link it up that way. And you've had the ability to do that for a while now. But it's not convenient. I mean,
I've tried using a Garmin Fenix watch or the Garmin Oregon, like you're saying, GPS device. It's just also just to, and not to beat this into the ground, but I've recently migrated, or I'm migrating over to the new Lightroom CC away from Classic, and they do not currently have any sort of GPS or geo tagging support. So that's frustrating.
Who earns on that one? All right. Yeah. Let's talk about two other, this is going to be quick, but two other patents from Canon, just kind of along the same lines. They're basically stating that the mirror box of a traditional SLR isn't dead yet, and there's new patents that will speed up the operation of that that have been filed. And, you know, it is obvious that the flagship cameras from Canon and Nikon, at least for their next generation, are going to have a mirror slapping about inside of them. That technology is not disappearing, but there are patents overly complex for this this stage in the podcast to really dive into. But it's interesting that tech is still evolving, and it's getting faster and better as time goes on. And if you pair that with a new patent, Canon's got a number of these out, and I'm not sure how many other people are patenting curved sensor technology, but Canon has a ton of them. At least I've seen them come up time and time again, where the ability to have a curved sensor within a camera body, that's going to be one of those revolutionary things. It's not going to be a simple upgrade. You're probably going to need an entirely new lens mount system in order to take advantage of this, because the optics need to be designed for this this shift in the way that the light falls onto the sensor.
Absolutely.
But you look at Canon, that doesn't have a full frame mirrorless body, and there have been rumblings and rumors about that for quite some time. We've talked about that on a previous episode. Could this be that one thing that makes a full frame mirrorless camera from Canon a desirable product above the magic that Sony and so many others have been producing? Would it be a game changer for you?
That's a really interesting prospect. It's a very poignant question, because, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but no matter what, I believe, but even when if Sony were to release, or is it true, would they have to, regardless of whether it's a curved sensor or not, if they went with a full frame mirrorless camera body, need a new mount anyway?
I don't know. There have been rumors one way or another. If they don't get a new mount for a mirrorless body on the Canon side of things, the flange distance from the rear element of the lens to the sensor has to remain the same. So you're not,
exactly,
you're not going to get a smaller body out of that.
Yep.
So keep that in mind. And there might be some way, if you have a curved sensor, to build some sort of corrective optic to use traditional lenses on it, but it wouldn't be a native match.
And exactly. So let's just assume, let's just, for the sake of argument, say that there is you, regardless of curved or not, if you're going full frame mirrorless and you want to reduce the distance, the flange distance, you need a new lens mount, which means you would need new lenses. If Canon were to go and throw in this curved sensor technology, which possibly the way light, as you said, the light hits it, how it affects sharpness, corner to corner, edge to edge sharpness, and color resolution or reproduction, rather, this would be really something special, because you're not just when Canon comes out with a full frame mirrorless camera, it's no matter what, at the end of the day, it's a Me Too product.
Yep.
Same thing with Nikon, because Sony has it there already. And so if Canon wants to kind of really elevate themselves, their name, their, you know, the stature, their legacy that they have in the digital imaging space. I mean, they did that when the 5D Mark II was released. And if they could come out with this and also come out with a decent series of launch lenses.
And well, that's key too, because no third parties will have an existing lens formula that they can adapt to the mount. So from a risk scenario, they're not going to come out with anything at launch. It all has to come from Canon to make it viable.
Yes. I would say I would be very, very interested in that, just because everyone, you know, maybe you could have a full frame sensor with less megapixels, but with the same I don't know, sharpness or resolving power as a higher megapixel camera, which gives you improved low light performance. And high ISO performance. So I don't know. I mean, I loved it. When I saw this, I was like, oh man, this would be really, really cool. This would be something that I would start. It would make me have sideways glances at my Sony stuff because I'm a Sony shooter. So
yeah, well, and it doesn't matter who you are shooting right now in terms of a brand, you'd be buying into a new system, even if you're a Canon shooter like I am. This is an entirely new set of lenses and camera bodies because, again, you'd have issues with compatibility. Correctable or not, it wouldn't be natively the same. The beautiful thing is, if you have a curved sensor, you don't have to worry about the corners getting tons of chromatic aberration and like you said, the resolving power for color and consistency within that in those areas and general sharpness that would fall off for the same reasons. So that means the optical formula of the lens can be simpler and the lens can be every bit as good, but a fraction of the price because you don't need to have all of these unusual and hard to manufacture aspherical lens elements made out of fluoride or other materials that are used to prevent or correct chromatic aberration. So at the end of the day, you could buy a camera and have a lot of money put into that camera body in terms of tech and less money put into the lenses, which is kind of inverted from what we do now. I mean, the traditional logic has always been buy a great lens and it will survive you forever. I know you're partnered up with Zeiss and Zeiss has some of the most amazing optics and their quality control is second to none. But at the same time, what if Zeiss could apply that same mentality to a simpler optical design and make a product that is every bit as good as their current lineup, but simpler and easier to manufacture, and thereby the cost goes down and becomes in more people's hands. There's a lot of potential here, but it's all it is right now is potential. We have no idea when or if we will see this, but Canon is poised because if they do come out with a new system, a new full frame mirrorless system, then if they don't put this in there, I think they're done.
Yeah. And I think that I believe that the Canon user base would forgive the fact that this technology necessitates a new lens system.
Yeah.
Because of, I want to see Canon innovate. I mean, I grew up on Canon. So, and I moved to Sony. If you go back and you see anything I've ever said about why I moved to Sony, it's because I like I need to see a company that's bullish about where technology is going in photography. And Sony was that company. I mean, they still are to a degree, but I want to see Canon kind of return from their fall from grace.
You know, competition helps everybody, right? When people, when everybody is pushing out innovation after innovation, we all benefit. Nobody loses in that scenario because the next time you go to buy a new camera, the companies have pushed themselves further into R&D debt in order to stay on top. And their profits might suffer from that because they're spending more and more money. But the average consumer is the beneficiary of that extra expense and effort. So yeah, more of it, please.
Yes.
On that note, talking about innovations, big and small, this is the pick of the week section where I think you've got something interesting that you'd like to share with us. You waved it to me earlier. Mm-hmm. What the heck is this?
So it's by a company called Peak Design, a San Francisco-based company, made huge waves with their Kickstarter campaigns. They make a variety of tools. The way I think of it is they rethink the accessories that photographers need and use, from camera bags and straps and whatnot. But speaking of straps, I hate neck straps, shoulder straps. I can't.
I don't
stand
have
them
one on my camera at all.
Exactly. Neither do I. What I have is, this is my pick. It's by Peak Design again. It's called the Capture Clip, and this is their second generation version, which is a little bit more svelte. Made out of, it's really durable. But what you do is, it comes with a plate that is Arca Swiss compatible, so it works in my Really Right Stuff ball head, or with my Really Right Stuff ball head. But when you have that plate on, it essentially attaches. You attach this to your strap of your backpack, your arm straps, mm-hmm. and just kind of sits there very passively. But when you take the plate that's attached to your camera, you can slide it in and it locks in place and it's secured. And so your camera basically is hanging off of the strap of your bag as opposed to around your neck or your shoulder. And then with one little button presses and releases it. And you can have, I carry two, one on either side. So if I'm double fisting cameras, I can quickly just grab one or the other.
That seems like a brilliant idea. The only potential issue, and I don't know if this is mm-hmm. what happens. You said that it's an instant release when you press that button. Mm-hmm. Well, have you ever accidentally pressed that button?
No, because two reasons. One, no, because it's not an easy press. You have to actually press it and lift up.
Right.
Because it's the weight, gravity and the weight of the camera is pushing it down. But there's also when I am walking and I know that I'm not going to need it, there's a lock. You can kind of pivot the button forward and it locks. So now you can't unlock it. It's essentially preventing.
They've thought of everything. So Peak Designs, this is a current product that they have. At what price?
Yes. I believe like 40 or 50 US. I actually should have looked that up.
At that point, I mean, that's reasonable in terms of photo gadgets. I mean, that's not outside the realm of saying, hey, I'm going to spend a couple of dollars on a new gizmo and put that to work for me. You know, I might use one. That's the kind
I
of thing.
I love it.
That's the kind of thing that just makes life easier. And it just kind of cleans up complexity. And it doesn't require me to go and put on a strap or a strap mount of any kind. I had a hand grip on the 1DX that Canon made a while ago. And they stopped manufacturing the one that I really liked. And if you look on eBay, there are Chinese aftermarket manufacturers that have made knockoffs of it. And they all suck. I bought two of them thinking that, hey, you know what, I'll find a good one, the good Canon version, and it's just not there. So,
and one of the nice things I like about it is when I was in Japan in December, instead of a camera, I attached the plate to the bottom of my GoPro. And so the GoPro is always kind of on my shoulder as opposed to, you know, people who have on a helmet or something. Yeah. It was just kind of at chin level. So given the wider focal length, it's a better perspective. So I used it walking in between, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of people through, you know, Shibuya or Shinjuku Station and stuff like that.
Oh, that's cool. No, that seems like a very useful multi-purposed tool. And I have one that, you know, if anybody has ever, you know, purchased filters all in one size, like mm-hmm. I've the biggest filter size I have for my lenses is 77 millimeters. So that's, I buy all of my filters in that size, even though some of my lenses are 58 millimeters or 62 millimeters. And so you'll need step-up adapters or step-down adapters, depending on the sizes. And if you go on eBay, you can easily find something for like $2 with free shipping from Hong Kong. And then you put it onto your filter and you will never get it off because they get stuck. And, you know, you try every trick, you know, using filter wrenches and everything else. I've had to use pliers in one case to try and wrench them apart. Well, a company that I really like and admire is Breakthrough Photography, and they make some outstanding polarizing filters and neutral density filters. A lot of people don't realize they also make step-up adapters. And if you've ever held a Breakthrough filter, they've got these really nice kind of gripped edge around the outside that, I mean, it's almost like it's serrated. I mean, it's not a blade or anything, but it's got these ups and downs. You can easily grab a hold of and spin against filters that might be there in contention. So it is really easy to take these things apart. I have not gotten this thing stuck at all. They also make it out of brass, so it's less likely to find like a point of just bonding and saying, yep, this is where I'll be for life. Yep. So I really, really like them. Yeah, they're definitely not $2 adapters, but chances are you spent really good money on good filters, and you might only need one or two of these step-up adapters in order to complete your collection, letting all of your filters play on all of your lenses. It is a pretty good option. Again, like you said, these little things, you know, a clip to hold a camera in place, or, you know, something to adapt your gear to be more versatile. Spending, you know, the $20, $30, $40, $50, so long as your life is more convenient for it. I spent 2 hours once trying to get a step-up adapter off of a filter when I had a somewhat timely project that needed to be completed that day. And I was like rummaging through the toolbox and getting everything I could possibly get. I ended up having to take a hacksaw to that step up adapter and
no
I
way.
Cut it off of the filter. And that was kind of treacherous because you don't want to damage the filter that's underneath it.
Like you said, you spend all that money on the filter. That's what you have to protect.
Well, exactly. And yeah, you know what? If you damage the mount that the filter is in, you can go on and you could buy a replacement mount for a filter as long as you don't damage the glass. And I was kind of thinking that my mind was in that mode of thinking, okay, well, if I break the filter thread here for this project, I can just tape it on the lens and I can buy another filter mount and take it apart and put it back together.
You're already on like plan B, C, D.
My mind should never go there. So just get a good quality, you know, gadget to begin with. And so Breakthrough, I'm really happy with these step up rings that they've produced, and they make them in every size from whatever diameter to whatever diameter. They're all there listed on their website. So cool. Good to have the right gear for the right occasion. As we wind down, the final tiny little bit that I want to kind of tease you with is you, like me, as we mentioned at the beginning, have a million things going on at any given time. What's the thing that you are most passionate about pushing forward into the next few months?
Ooh, on the spot question. For me, what I'm actually most interested in is kind of resurging a love that I used to have. One of the earliest types of photography that I really practiced was kind of urbex and abandoned photography. And so I have a trip planned in April going back there. And I've been thinking about this, how to approach this particular trip unlike my other urbex shoots. And so I'm very excited to kind of really take it. I don't have everything dialed in yet in terms of what I want to get out of it, but it's something that, again, we're early February at this point, but to think about. That project is what's been.
Where are you going?
Detroit.
Detroit. Just like So Detroit is, it is the mecca of, let's call it recreational trespassing.
In the US, for sure.
But, Brian, if you ever find yourself in Eastern Europe, in Bulgaria, which is where my wife is originally from, there is a building called Buzulja. It is the former headquarters of the Communist Party of Bulgaria during the era of the Soviet Union. I have not gained proper permission to access the building on two occasions, and it is the most beautifully destroyed building I have ever seen. I hear now that it's harder to get into.
As is always the case.
But the first time we just kind of crawled through a hole in the door. The second time we had to climb up a bunch of rubble, and there was a hole in between two levels of stairs that we had to crawl through. And this building is, if you want to see something that will top all other urbex experiences ever, go here. I'll put a photo in the show notes to one of the images that I've taken of it. But if you ever want to go, my wife and I, as a family trip, we go back there every year. Not specifically to that location. My wife is originally from the country. We visit family and friends, and we go on a road trip. We could maybe time something if you want to dive into that.
I'd love to explore that.
Yeah. It's interesting, especially when you get into some of the unusual locations in Russia, where they had a shuttle program that was shut down before it ever launched, and they've got like abandoned Russian space shuttles, reusable space shuttles, just rotting in the hangars where they were built.
Don't tell me this.
No,
I want to go.
It is so cool, the places in the world that you can go and explore. And that urban decay, I think, tells a story. No matter where you are, there's a different story to tell. And it's just the photographer in you has to make the most out of that.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, and I'll say that I've got some photography workshops coming up in the spring and summer that I'm really, really excited for. I've got my water droplet refraction workshops, which show people how to take a water droplet and turn it into a lens. So you can put a flower in behind and have the flower show up in the water droplet, cover a dandelion seed full of water droplets. It looks like a little mini tree growing flowers all over it. It's a really fun subject to explore. And those workshops are only 3 hours long. By the end of it, you've got everything you need to recreate those shots, and you're limited only by your creativity. And I've got a full day macro workshop in mid-August, I think August 11th, if I'm not mistaken. And we roll a little bit of that in there as well. And that's all done here in my home studio, where we've got award-winning gardens. And I'm actually, while it's snowflake season for me, I am eager for spring to come, because I think I'm sick and tired of the snow at this point.
You need a change.
You need a change after a little while. And it'll come. It'll come. I think all the groundhogs said there's 6 more weeks of winter. So, or at least that's whatever it averages out to. So we'll play it as it comes. But the summer is going to be what I'm pretty much looking forward to here at this point. All right. Well, we have, might be the longest episode ever. but it's been a fun conversation. And for a relatively slow news week, I'm glad we could opine on as long as we have. And on that note, maybe you've even been listening to us while you've been shooting. But if you haven't, you should most certainly get out and shoot.